the benefits of a New York City public school education. My daughter is in fifth grade now, and every time I talk to one of her teachers and am struck by their intelligence, talent, and dedication, I know that I've made the right decision. The teachers of New York City are inspiring her, too. Oh, and Mr. Baratta, you and Shakespeare were right. All the world is a stage.
Join New York's brightest, Teach NYC. Go to www.teachnyc.net to find out more. This message brought to you by the New York City Department of Education, Appleseed, and the Ad Council.
WNJC, Washington Township,
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia's Renaissance Radio Station.
Brought to you
from Forsyth Broadcasting.
Or listen to us at WNJC1360.com.
This is the Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show, WNJC 1360, Progressive Liberal Talk Radio. The news you need to know that you don't get anywhere else.
Okay, and welcome to another night, the Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show, and tonight we're going to talk about a couple of items. I'm going to have two guests on. Both of them were arrested yesterday for speaking out for Americans for health care rather than worrying about big and giant insurance companies, which is what all the members of Congress seem to be doing, or too many of them anyway. And that's a bipartisan thing happening there, where both the Democrats and the Republicans are screwing us. But first I want to talk about Saturday, close to 300 people went to Franklin Mills Mall, just on the very outskirts of Philadelphia, and they protested against the Army Experience Center. Now, I spoke about this before. It was a great turnout. There were people came from New York, Connecticut, Virginia, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Delaware, and they basically talked about how the Army is engaging in an experiment here. If you go to your average recruiting center, it's about 1,000 square feet, 1,500 square feet, maybe. This Army Experience Center is about 14,000 square feet. Now, they deny that it's a recruiting center, but the fact is that's exactly what it is, only it's aimed at young kids. It's aimed at kids who are not old enough to be recruited. They've placed it in the mall directly across from a skateboard park, a Woodward skateboard park, a fabulous dream skateboard park. And so they're going to maximize getting teenage boys there. And then they have schools arranging trips to this place. And it's an incredible experience. I mean, if I was a teenager, you know, and just a naive kid, it would probably be a lot of fun. They have real helicopters there, two of them. They have a real Humvee, a real troop carrier. And then they have dozens and dozens of computer screens of all different sizes, some of them filling walls, all set up to play video games. So the thing is, almost every day in Pakistan, American-flown drones are shooting missiles that kill people, often innocent civilians. The people operating those drones, they're usually like kids playing video games. And that's the future of the Army, video game murder. So when these protesters came, what they did was they complained that the Army Experience Center was engaged in child abuse because they're teaching the children to do things that are pretty awful. They're teaching them how to murder. They're encouraging them to kill. One of our writers, and I had him on a couple weeks ago, Dave Lindendorf, brought his teenage son there, and he tried it out. And when they were done, he said, he was told, you did pretty good. You only had a 20% civilian kill rate. So, and that 20% of the people he killed were civilians. It was a good turnout. Now, what was very interesting in this is that the leaders of it coordinated with the mall, and they coordinated with the police. The mall didn't have to let them in. It's private property. But the leaders of this demonstration were able to work with the mall so that the mall actually let them in. They were able to work with the police, so the police knew what was happening and could plan for it and anticipate it. And it was not violent. There were some people who got arrested. They chose to get arrested. And the rest of the people engaged in a protest in a what you would consider to be a visibility protest, a visibility demonstration. When it comes to activism, one of the things you want to consider is how do you get the message out there? Well, this was a visibility demonstration, a protest that brought TV news, multiple print news sources, and it was an excellent way to get the message out that there's a problem here. There were some people who tried to engage the police and bait them. And the police are pros at this. I have to say I was very, very impressed by the way that the Philadelphia police handled it. They have their own civil, I'm not sure the exact words for it. It's civil community affairs or something like that, department that's been around for over 50 years. And it's their job to deal with protests and demonstrations and civil disobedience. And they're very polished and professional about it. And I have to give them a lot of credit. They let it go on. The protesters did their job. They did arrest some people, but those were people who had made a decision in advance that they were going to do what it took to get arrested. Now, why did they get arrested? That's an interesting question. Why? And the answer is there are a couple possible reasons. One reason is, if people get arrested during an event, that's bigger news. So if a person chooses to get arrested, then it can help to elevate the level of the newsworthiness of the story. That's a reason. There was also some speculation that some people did it for street cred. Hey, I was out there protesting and I've been arrested. Have you? That's not as good a reason, I don't think. But the first reason is a good reason. The headline for a lot of the stories was protesters, people arrested, or seven people arrested. I think it was seven people who were arrested. So this was a good example of how activists were able to work with the system, with the mall, with the police, to accomplish their goal, which was to get a message out. They didn't expect to shut it down. They didn't expect to blockade it. That was not the goal. They got the job done, and I have to give them a lot of credit. I think it was Reverend Bob Moore and Bob Smith and Bill Deckhart and Kathy Leary. There were people there from a whole lot of different organizations. Coalition for Peace Action is a group that I work with that was there. Veterans Against War and for Peace. Iraq Veterans Against War. There's what's the one? Can't Wait Now. Will Can't Wait. Code Pink. A lot of groups that all work together to make this happen and make it happen successfully. Then today, I went with three other colleagues who have been working with me. Who I've been working with because they're doing more lead work than me, really. We went to meet with the Bucks County Courier-Times editorial board to talk about getting the paper to cover our perspective on healthcare. And our perspective is an interest in both single-payer and public option for healthcare. And it's not the first time I've been to an editorial board meeting. But it was really a good experience. We set up the meeting. They knew we were a serious group because they've covered the seven town halls that we've held. and they've done a great job covering them. It may even be more than that. I think it was just 7 on healthcare. We've probably done more like 10 altogether. And they've given some of them front page, top of the headline coverage. So they knew who we were. They knew we were serious activists, and they treated us that way. And they gave us an hour of their time, and we presented our case to them. We told them what we would like, which is for them to continue to cover it, to either write about some of the specific topics we are interested in or to publish articles that we were willing to write. And they asked us questions about different issues involved in single-payer and public-option health care. And it was an excellent experience. This is something that I encourage you to consider doing if you're an activist and if you're involved in a group. Go to your local daily paper, go to your weekly paper, and contact them and say, we'd like to sit down with you and talk to you about our issues and how we'd like you to cover them. This is something that professional organizations do. This is something that professional activists do. But you know, you got to start somewhere. Those professional activists, somebody took one of them and said, well, let's do this. You can do it. Go for it. Go to your local paper if you're an activist and call for a meeting. And you know, the way it works out is that very often activists are involved in different groups. So there's a good chance I'll be back there next week because there's going to be a peace group meeting with them. And I'll probably good chance be a part of that, as will some of the other people who were in the meeting. And it's a great way to get to know the paper. All of a sudden, you go from being... seeing them as the ugly, nasty mainstream media to being real people with real faces who you can talk to, who you can negotiate with, who you can persuade to do their job, to cover all the aspects of the story, and they listen. They really listen. They want to do a good job, and they hear you. And that's a good thing. That's a really good thing to be able to work with the media. And this is something that a lot more could be done with. I have so much experience as publisher of www.opednews.com, one of the best and most wonderful progressive liberal media sites on the planet, which you should absolutely check out and subscribe to the daily newsletter for. That's www.opednews.com. As publisher of that, I'm in contact with thousands of activists and people who care about politics and who care about making a difference in a world. And these are two examples, the protest that was coordinated with the mall and the police and the meeting with the local daily paper, where activists can literally deal with some of the people and the organizations that are usually seen as adversaries. It's a really nice idea, and it's powerful, and it's effective, and it's simple, and you can do it. So, this is Rob Cole, Bottom Up Radio, WNJC 1360, and what I'm talking to you about is how you can be an activist and how you can take more power personally in your life to make a difference in the world. We're at a time when there are more people and more organizations in the world trying to make a difference, trying to make the world a better place than ever before in history. These are people who are conscious, who have woken up and decided that they want to do something, and they want to take action, and they want to get involved, and that may be you, or it may be that you're just thinking about it, and there are so many groups out of there, all you got to do is Google them, and put in some of the topics you care about, and you'll find groups and people who are doing things that you care about, and that you want to work for. And you can go to them, and you can help them, and you can make a difference because all those groups need help. They all do. So just go there, be persistent, contact them, tell them what your strengths are and what you can do and what you're willing to do, the time you're able to put in, and you can help them. OpEdNews.com, we're always looking for all kinds of volunteers, particularly editors and transcribers, but others as well. So maybe you want to be a volunteer for opednews.com. Check us out, www.opednews.com, and hopefully we'll hear from you and you'll find out. Or go to your local organization. There are hundreds of thousands of them all over the world. You can make a difference. You personally can make a difference. Believe it. Now, I think I just heard our guest come on. Did I?
Yes. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Great. How you doing?
I'm good.
Good. And after your experience. So you just got arrested yesterday, eh?
Yes, I did.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks. It was a first.
It was a first. So you're not a serial offender, eh, yet?
No, I hope I haven't offended too many people, but no, I am. No, that was a first experience for me. I didn't really see myself heading down that road, but there it was.
So, now your name is Margaret Flowers, M.D.?
Yes.
But do you go by Margaret, or?
Yeah, Margaret is fine.
Great. And what kind of doctor are you?
I'm a pediatrician.
Pediatrician, okay. Uh-huh. So, you were arrested yesterday in Washington at the Senate hearing on health care, right?
Right. It was actually a roundtable event that was open to the public, one of three in a series designed to discuss health care reform, but actually the public's not allowed to speak. And they're being held within the Senate Finance Committee.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about it and what happened and why you were there and what you wanted to say and what they wouldn't let you say and what they said.
Sure. Well, Personally, I am co-chair of the Maryland chapter of Physicians for National Health Program, and I work with a number of other organizations around the country who all educate about and advocate for creating a national health system based on single-payer financing. We consider that healthcare is a human right. And we learned last week who had been invited to this roundtable discussion, and it was more of the same of what we've been seeing in Washington these past few months of only the interests, private health insurance and big, you know, business interests were being represented there. And we've been meeting with members of Congress and senators, gosh, since even before the session started, talking to them about creating a national health system and how the majority of people want that, the majority of physicians want that, and weren't really getting anywhere. And so when we saw who was invited to this roundtable, we felt it was important to ask that we be included. And so last week we mounted these call-in and fax-in days where constituents from the states that the senators who are on the committee, where they come from, sent thousands of contacts into the offices asking them to include single payer. And on Monday we got the final word, which was that no more invitations were going to be given. So we decided that we would go and see what we could do. We was eight of us. We dressed in our professional attire, hoping that we could be invited to sit at the table and speak with the other roundtable members. And
does that mean you wore white coats?
We didn't. We left our white coats at home, actually. But we dressed respectively. And when we got into the hearing just before it started, one of our members stood up and said, "I have three doctors here. They're, knowledgeable about single payer. Will you allow them to sit at the table? Will you allow our voice to be heard?" And he was arrested. So we decided that if that happened, we would just stand up one by one and make, similar requests. And we were each in turn escorted out and arrested. So that's the story. It wasn't, I wish it could have been different.
How many people were arrested?
There were eight of us. Three of us are physicians. Three women, two grandmothers, and I have children of my own, but not a grandmother yet.
And who ordered the arrests?
Well, Senator Baucus did. I didn't understand the significance that when you hammer on with the gavel and if someone continues speaking, that means that you committed a pretty serious crime, and he was hammering the gavel. It was just, it was a very strange atmosphere, which was kind of disquieting, because one of the significant things about our actions that we wore black because we wanted that to represent the mourning for the number of Americans who die because we don't have a health care system. I mean, this is really pretty serious. We are the only industrialized nation that allows so many thousands of people to die every year and others to suffer because they can't get the health care that they need. And to us, we take this very seriously. And as I sat there in the hearing room waiting for things to begin, what I saw, at the at the table where the senators were gathering and the staff and the members who were going, you know, the representatives who were going to be speaking, there was a lot of, you know, everybody's laughing and smiling, and they all looked very comfortable and, you know, very happy. And I thought, you know, that I don't think that they understand what, you know, what the seriousness of this is. And so as I sat there, I thought about the people out there who don't have a voice and who are suffering. And so when we first, you know, started making the request, we were actually laughed at. You know, everybody thought, oh, this is so funny, what a little show that's going on. But we were really quite serious, and so that was disturbing.
I'm reading, I'm looking at a commentary by Donna Smith. I'm sure you know Donna.
Yes, I do.
Donna is a nurse who was on Michael Moore's movie.
She actually works for California Nurses, but she's not a nurse. She was actually an editor.
Oh, I
newspaper
she
editor.
For the nurses. Oh, okay.
Yeah. But she lost everything. She and her husband, they had worked all their lives. They had insurance, had a disability plan and a health savings account. And when she got cancer, their medical bills were so high that they lost everything they owned, their house and everything.
And she says you were not only arrested, but you were handcuffed, too.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And not one senator spoke up for you.
Exactly.
Not one.
No.
You know, I was talking to Chuck Pinocchio. Do you know Chuck?
I do know Chuck.
Yeah. He's a local guy, a good friend. And he's attempting to get single-payer health care in Pennsylvania.
Right.
And it occurred to me that there are so many deep-pocket corporate interests that have a stake in maintaining the broken, immoral system that we currently have. And I started thinking, if we switch to single-payer, it's still going to be trillions of dollars in business. What kind of company, what kind of organization would have a stake, a profit in being involved in the single payer? Is there any kind of an organization that would do well with it, or that could be approached for help? I guess the nursing organizations are one. But are there any kinds of companies that would benefit, or would all the profit be sucked out and nobody's interested in it from a corporate perspective because of that? Because if there was somebody who was interested, if there was a company that could see some profit, that might be a way to get some advocacy going at a corporate level, and it doesn't seem that there is.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thought. No, there is not really any advocacy at the corporate level. And what our hope is that, because the private insurance industry is really not an asset to healthcare in this country, it actually takes away from healthcare by denying and restricting care. So we want to get private health insurer profit interest out of healthcare, needed healthcare. But then certainly, you know, there's just going to be needs for software, and you know, like France has a really excellent system where each patient has a card with a microchip in it that contains some of their medical information. It makes it easy for doctors and pharmacists to have that right at hand wherever the patient goes. You know,
right. I think Japan or Taiwan, they have those too.
They use the same system that France did in terms of their card, and then they actually modeled their system after our Medicare. After looking at countries all around the world and evaluating their systems, they chose Medicare as their model.
Fascinating. Well, you know, I don't know how early you got on to the call, but I was talking about how I went with a couple of local activists to our local daily newspaper, the Bucks County Couriers,
mm-hmm.
and we met with them to talk about how we were advocating for increasing reader awareness about single-payer and public health care, HCAN and single-payer universal. And the response was excellent. We met with the publisher, the managing and assistant editor, and the healthcare reporter for the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was saying earlier, they were very responsive, and I think that we our goals for the meeting will have been met in the next couple weeks.
They
asked some good questions. Like one question that maybe you can help me with,
sure.
They asked. What about the nonprofits? I mean, are they really a problem? And I mean, how do they fit into the picture in terms of public versus private?
You mean the not-for-profits? Like
the Blues.
In Maryland? Yeah, we have Blue Shield, right, across here, CareFirst. They're a big part of the problem as well. CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield is one of the dominating insurers in Maryland, and despite the fact that they're supposed to be not-for-profit, they're running a surplus of about 800% of what the recommended level is, and they pay their CEOs very high salaries. Despite the fact that they've been able to lower their administrative costs, they've continued to raise premiums in this state, so they're not passing any savings on to the people in this state. And they've been pretty miserable to deal with in terms of trying to get, you know, health care paid for patients. So even though they call themselves not-for-profit, they really do operate much like a for-profit, you know, corporation.
And I guess they're so big, it's that who's going to tell them what to do?
It's very hard, yeah. When people talk about regulating private insurance, you know, a lot of times people will use, you know, when they talk about having a healthcare system in the United States that includes both public and private, they often point to countries like Switzerland and Germany where they have private insurers. But there's a complete difference between those corporations in Europe and our private insurance corporations, because those are actually modeled as social insurance. Their intention is to pay for health care, whereas our business model in the United States with investor-owned private insurers is to create profit by restricting and denying care. So they're completely opposite models. But to think that we're going to regulate this private insurance industry, which is so out of control, and make them, you know, actually pay for health care reasonably, it makes no sense. It costs a lot of money to regulate. And they're always going to be taking off their portion of the money, which could be used for paying for health care. So it's a waste of money.
Yeah, I pointed out in this meeting that we really don't have a health care system.
Exactly.
We have a health care industry and chaos.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very fragmented. There's no accountability, no transparency. Yeah, I agree. That's a good point.
And yet it looks like there's no possibility that single-payer universal health care, which is what I think most Americans would really like, it's off the table.
It's off the table only in Congress because, you know, health care providers and patients want it. I mean, we did a one-hour radio show earlier this evening, three of us who were arrested yesterday together, and every caller that called in from, you know, even physicians called in, said they supported a single-payer healthcare system. So the problem is particularly the Senate. In the House, we are getting some support, but the Senate is really very much, I guess, heavy into, you know, the corporate pocket. They receive a lot of funding, and so they're not budging.
Are there any members of the Senate who have expressed any support at all?
Sure, I shouldn't be so absolute, because actually Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont actually has a single-payer bill. It's S-703.
Bernie's the best senator in the Senate, no doubt about it.
Yeah, he doesn't have any co-sponsors yet.
Not one?
But we're hoping.
Yeah, he's been a guest on the show. And I had John Conyers on a couple weeks ago.
Oh, he's our hero.
He is. He really is a hero.
Yeah, he really understands it. He really understands how everything is connected. You know, we can't really recover economically if we don't do something about health care. And single-payer is the only solution that saves money.
This is what I tried to get across to the editorial board, that America is not ever going to be competitive, that staying addicted to private insurance is going to damage all our other industries and keep us from being competitive on a world market. If America wants to be involved in a global market, then the only way to do it competitively is to have single-payer universal health care.
Exactly, yeah. And even at home, being able to have a productive society, people are so burdened down by the fact that, you know, they don't have any health security. If they get sick, they risk losing everything. Businesses are spending so much money trying to provide health insurance for their employees that this is money they should be using, you know, towards innovating and hiring more people and all the things that businesses are supposed to do that they're free to do in other countries.
So now you're saying that single payer is the only kind of insurance that's going to save money?
Exactly. There was a study, there have been multiple studies done, but yeah.
How much?
Well, it's estimated that that in just administrative savings alone, there would be about $400 billion a year saved. And then you can add into that the cost, the savings we'll make on pharmaceuticals, because we'll be able to negotiate for price, better prices on pharmaceuticals. And then eventually, you know, as things get coordinated and we get more of an emphasis on prevention, we should hopefully have a healthier population, and that saves money as well.
So you're talking about saving $400 billion plus the money saved on pharmaceuticals and at the same time covering every American.
Right.
And making companies more competitive so they can be more profitable and have more of a market internationally, which
right.
is not even accounted for in looking at the numbers.
Right.
And then we've got the thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who go bankrupt whose lives are totally devastated because of this immoral system that we have.
Right. Over 1 million people a year go bankrupt in this country.
Over a million.
Just due to medical debt. Yeah. And then add in the fact that if we had a national health system with, well, like a single-payer system, physicians and patients would be making medical decisions, not health insurers. And people would have more choice of physician, healthcare provider, health facility, because everybody would be in the same program. So you don't have to worry about in-network or out-of-network. Where, you know, where can I go? That question is gone.
You know, I just heard a story. The reporter in this meeting said that women in her 20s was denied health insurance because she had acne.
Oh, we hear amazing denials. A friend of mine was denied because when she was pregnant with her twins, she saw a doctor because she thought she was getting varicose veins. And this is a woman who exercises regularly, is very healthy, and she was denied health insurance just because of that. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's beyond crazy. It's criminal.
It is.
And it's something that this members of the Senate should be ashamed of, that they're not getting behind single payer and nothing else.
Right, despite the fact that you're asking them to.
So, you know, if you're listening to this show tonight and you feel like calling in, we're not taking calls. I usually don't. But call your senator. And
yeah.
Not just your senator, call your member of Congress, the House of Representatives, and tell them that they should sign on to the single-payer bill in the House. That's H.R. 676. They should sign, and the senators should sign on to Bernie Sanders' bill, and they should support that. And if they just can't possibly stand to do it because they've been given so much money from health insurance lobbyists, they should at least support the public option so that people can get insurance that is provided by the government as an option instead of getting it from a private insurer.
Yeah.
And then call your state legislator, because the state legislators have an option, too, particularly in Pennsylvania, where there's a lot of work being done by activists trying to get Pennsylvania to be the first state to provide single-payer universal health care. Canada started out with one province providing single-payer universal health care, and then the whole country went that way. So if one state does it, if Pennsylvania does it, it's going to almost force New Jersey to do it and New York to do it and Ohio and West Virginia, because the companies in Pennsylvania will be so much more competitive than the other companies.
it's a huge win for
Democrats.
And people
are going to move to Pennsylvania. Huh?
Right. If Democrats were able to pass a single-payer national health system, they would really be, I think, guaranteed to stay in power for a long time because people are going to love it so much.
I agree. I think that they just don't get it. They just don't see that this is what people really want.
Right.
So what can we do? What are steps that our listeners can take?
Good. Other than, you know, contacting the representatives. Now, as far as Physicians for National Health Program goes, we don't support the public option because it's not going to solve a lot of problems. Maryland PNHP feels it would be better not to pass anything this year if they're going to pass a public-private option, and we could go into that or not. But we see this as the civil rights movement of this era, and the only way that we're going to overcome these interests and create a system that works for patients and providers is by doing the things that we've been doing. Other than contacting representatives, it's going to take putting direct pressure, you know, from the districts. You know, if you need to do knocking on doors to collect petition signatures to convince your representative, you need to do that. If it takes acts of civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience, that's probably what it's going to take to overcome these huge interests.
And Philadelphia, where we have our symbol is primarily reaching Metro Philly, Philadelphia is desperately in need of money. The city is so hurting. If Philadelphia had single-payer universal health care, it would save at least $400 million a year. And every person in the city would have insurance then.
Right.
I can't understand. Go ahead.
The thing here is that we base our insurance on employment. So when you become ill and can't work, the time that you need your health insurance, you lose it. It's another aspect that makes absolutely no sense.
Well, and that's if you have insurance that actually protects you. I mean, what about all the people who have insurance that really lets them down or runs out after a certain amount of time, or if they renew their insurance every 3 or 6 months, and if they get sick, they can't renew it anymore, and all of a sudden they're totally out of luck then.
That's why
there are a million people a year who go bankrupt because of health problems.
Right, and 76% of those people going medically, you know, declaring medical bankruptcy had insurance when they started their illness. So you're right, insurance does not protect you.
76% had insurance. So if you think you're safe just because you have insurance, if you're looking and saying, oh, that's for the other people, that's for people who don't work or who aren't paying their dues, you're wrong.
Right.
It could be you. It may be that somebody you love gets sick with something that's very expensive, and it goes over the lifetime budget or the annual budget. And the next thing you know, you're owing tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you have to sell your house. You have to sell your car. You have to spend the savings for your children's educations. This happens to over a million people a year, and it shouldn't. It shouldn't happen to anyone. When you ask somebody in Germany or Canada or Italy or France, do you go bankrupt if you have a lot of medical problems? They look at you like you're crazy.
Exactly.
A million Americans. You know, 3,000 people were killed in 9/11. A million people have their lives devastated every year in America. Why? So that some stinking corporate insurance president, CEO, can take home $200, $300, $500 million a year in pay. I'm not exaggerating, am I?
Oh, no, not at all. The CEOs of Aetna and United Healthcare, they have, I think one of them has almost $2 billion in stocks and bonds, making around, you know, $50 million a year.
These people are scum. These people are scum, and they should be in jail, because what they do is they perpetuate a system that is a monstrous, it's a monstrosity, and it should end. It should not be like this anymore. You know, my next guest is going to be Russell McIver. He was with you down there, right?
Yes.
Yeah. He should be on any moment now, too, so if you want to stick around, you're welcome to.
I'd love to say hi. And we've all been so busy that we haven't been able to talk to each other since we got released from the jail.
What was it like? What happened to you? What did they actually do? I mean, was it the Capitol Police that took you in?
It was the Capitol Police, and they, you know, handcuffed us and put us in the paddy wagon and processed us, you know, the whole, we were handcuffed to the wall and spent some time in a cell. And what was really moving about that experience was that one of the officers who was processing us told us the story of his mother, who's like 62, who lost her job, so she lost her health insurance, and he paid her COBRA for a little while, but then couldn't afford it anymore, and she can't find another job, and she's not old enough to get Medicare yet, so she has no access to health care. So that kind of, you know, was kind of ironic that he was arresting us because we were protesting, well, speaking out on behalf of people just like his mother.
Not one senator spoke up. That is shameful.
No, they laughed at us.
Did I hear, or is that Russell? I guess he's not here yet. I thought I heard him. Now, from what I understand, this finance committee is run by two people who oppose not only single payer, but even the public option. Is that correct?
I did hear Senator Baucus speak a few weeks ago, and he said that the public option was likely to become a bargaining chip that they would use to bargain with the health insurers to make them, quote-unquote, behave. So they'll threaten them with the public option, but then if the insurers say, oh, of course we'll behave, then they'll, you know, drop the public option. We really think that it's better if they're not going to create a system that at least actually moves us towards a single-payer system, because there's no evidence that creating this public-private partnership will move towards a single-payer system. It's actually quite the opposite. It's better, really, that they don't pass something and that we continue to push for a real debate, a real discussion, a real evaluation of a system that's focused on care, not on providing insurance.
Yes, because that's what we have right now. We have an illness treatment business,
right,
pretty much.
Well, we had a state senator from Massachusetts come down and speak in Congress, and he said that he was upset that the whole conversation while they were debating the Massachusetts legislation was focused on providing insurance, and nobody really actually talked about how they were going to make sure everybody in Massachusetts could get health care. So we need to change that conversation.
How do we do that?
By becoming educated ourselves, by speaking to others, and by continuing to remind our legislators that that's what the focus is. It's about care.
Now, you mentioned earlier about civil disobedience and protest. Now, that's exactly what you did yesterday.
Yeah.
You got yourself arrested. Now, I just want to do a station ID. This is Rob Call on the Bottom Up Radio Show, WNJC 1360, sponsored by www.opednews.com. where you're going to get progressive news and opinion, the kind that you're not going to find on the mainstream media. And we're talking to Dr. Margaret Flowers, a pediatrician who from Maryland, who was arrested yesterday for speaking out to the Senate saying, why don't you have anybody representing single-payer universal health care at a discussion about making a change in the current health chaos business that's existing in this country? And let me. So you engaged in civil disobedience yesterday, and you got a lot of good exposure. What's it going to cost you? How is that going to affect your life, having been arrested like this?
Yeah, I don't understand quite all the ramifications quite yet. They did give us two charges. We had thought that if we were arrested, we would get a simple charge that we could pay with a fine. And I think Senator Baucus was pretty upset about our disruption. And so we were given two charges, which means we have to go to trial. And I think we are facing 6 months. I think we qualify for going to a trial by jury. So I'm still, you know, fortunately, there was one lawyer in our group, and he's been consulting with other lawyers, so we're still kind of trying to figure out what all of this means. And there may be some effect on our medical license. Three of us were physicians, two of us licensed, one's retired. So we need to sort that out as well.
There could be an effect when you're licensed for speaking up and protesting?
Right. You know, when you renew your license, you have to say whether you've been arrested or convicted of any crimes, and it's up to the medical board to decide, you know, what their judgment is on that. And we kind of decided, the two of us, that it was easy to say back before we were arrested, that, you know, if we were arrested and that became an issue, that was an important discussion that we needed to have with the medical board, because we felt that we were acting out of integrity, that we were acting in the best interest of our patients, and that other physicians should be doing the same thing.
And you've said that most physicians that you know of support single-payer universal health care?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's growing very quickly, too. We speak with physicians every day.
That's not the case for the AMA, though.
No, but the AMA doesn't really represent the majority of physicians. The membership in the AMA only is about 30% of physicians in America. But there was actually a study done 2 years ago where they used the database from the AMA and sent out surveys to physicians. So they were surveying a fairly conservative group of physicians nationwide, and 59% of them wanted a national health program. And when they had done the same survey 5 years earlier, it had been 49%. So that was an increase of 10% in 5 years from a fairly conservative group of physicians.
Are there statistics on how the general public and what percentage of them want a national health, single-payer, universal health care system?
Yeah, there have been a number of polls, CBS, New York Times, Yahoo, and they all pretty consistently show around like in somewhere in the 60% mark of the public want a national health program.
Does that mean that 40% don't want it, or some percent don't, and some percent don't know, or what is
exactly.
It?
Exactly. Some percent don't, and some don't know, and I'm not sure of the exact numbers on that. I don't have an answer on that. And if you look at Democrats, it's much higher. It's in the 80s.
Yeah, you would expect that. And, of course, you know, one of the big arguments that the right-wingers, libertarians and Republicans and what have you, argue is that this they call national health care socialism, socialized medicine.
Yeah, as
though that's a nasty thing, bad thing.
That really just is a lack of understanding of what it is that we're talking about, because it's not socialism. I mean, I try to tell people the story of, you know, a long time ago in America, you had to have fire insurance. You paid your fire insurance and you had a plaque that you put on your house. And if your house caught on fire, whichever private fire department you had, you know, purchased insurance with, they would come and put out your house fire. And if you didn't have it, your house was just allowed to burn to the ground. And people said that wasn't really acceptable. So we created a public fire department system so that wouldn't happen. You know, we have public schools and public roads because this is part of what a society provides. And healthcare needs to be the same thing, because healthcare is not something that you can use a free market model to address. It just doesn't work that way, because you make money by providing, you know, insurance companies make money by providing less care, so, or paying for less care. So it doesn't fit in that model.
It sure doesn't. So it doesn't look good, though, right now, does it? What does it look like? What's coming up in the next couple months? I mean, they're talking about wanting to make something happen by October, from what I understand.
Yeah, there's this huge sense of urgency. They want to have legislation out by August and have it voted on by November at the latest, or they feel like they're missing this window. And so these events that they're having, these healthcare discussions, are really very well scripted. They're all trying to just move it in this one direction, but it's going to be moving towards creating reform that's not going to meet the principles that we believe are important, that are to, you know, include everybody, to remove financial barriers from getting healthcare, to remove the risk of medical bankruptcy, to improve health outcomes. So
And as I've mentioned, to eliminate the disadvantage that American industry and corporations have in competing internationally, that's a huge one. That while we're struggling with this economic disaster that we've been facing, should be on the table. The automobile companies are going out of business because they've been paying enormous health insurance costs that every other automobile manufacturer in other countries does not have to contend with.
Right.
And it shouldn't be.
Right.
So if they're moving forward with this charade,
mm-hmm.
that where does that leave the hopes for single payer?
It just means we have to continue organizing and educating and building the movement, and we need more people to get involved and more people to be willing to see this as a human rights issue and be willing to take the risks of doing what it takes to convince their members of Congress in a nonviolent way.
I'm talking to Dr. Margaret Flowers, MD, who was arrested yesterday for speaking out, calling for insurance for everybody in America. And this is WNJC 1360, the Rob Call Bottom-Up Radio Show. And Dr. Flowers, I want to thank you, because what you've done is courageous. You literally put your job, your career on the line for us. What are there websites that people can go to find out more about how they can get involved?
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, you can. If you want to learn more about a national health system and what that means, you can go to our Physicians for a National Health Program website, which is www.P as in Peter, N as in Nancy, HP as in Peter.org, PNHP.org. And to learn how to get involved in actions, I recommend that you go to www.healthcare-now.org. And you'll see that May 30th is a National Day of Action. People are organizing town hall meetings all around the country, and that's a great place to learn about what's happening in your area.
And you want to go, and you want to meet other people who are working on this, and you want to drag people along with you, and you want to talk to people, because this is not something that you can just leave alone anymore. It is too important. It's not just about you and you having the insurance for you to go to the doctor and get your medication covered. This is about America having a huge problem. What, you know, America is no longer in the top 10. Is it even in the top 20 in terms of the quality of health care?
No.
Where do we fit in?
We ranked 37th in terms of health outcomes around countries around the world, which puts us below the other industrialized nations. We're the only industrialized nation that has a rising infant mortality. That means rising number of children, babies who die every year, and we're 2 to 3 times higher than other industrialized countries in terms of the number of babies and mothers that are dying every year. So it's really, in some areas of our country, our health outcomes look very much like what you would see in a developing nation.
This is not anything to be proud of. This is shameful. This is something that is the shame of America.
Yeah.
If you think of America as being the best, if you think of our health care as being the best, you're deluding yourself. Our health care system sucks. Our health care system is below some banana republics. It's an embarrassment, and it's a total shameful situation. Now, yeah, I mentioned in an email to you that I'd like to talk about bottom-up ideas.
Mm-hmm.
How does single-payer universal health care compare to for-profit health care in terms of being a bottom-up versus a top-down system? Is there a way to compare it in that? Are there any comparisons in looking at them from the two different perspectives?
Yeah, I think that there are, and I found it interesting because I fall into your category of people over 30 who haven't been raised with the bottom-up mentality. So I really am intrigued to read some of the books that you listed in the email. But I guess When you think of a for-profit health system, it's really driven, you know, towards creating a profit by, you know, placing a lot of barriers and obstacles for people to actually get health care. What happens when we create a national health system is that everybody's in the same system, so everybody has a stake in making it be a good system, and it removes those administrators from making medical decisions. It really allows us to restore the health provider-patient relationship, because you can, you know, in consultation, you decide what's the best thing, and so you have, you know, more choice, more freedom that way.
And so really, the for-pay health insurance is a hierarchical model. Not everybody can afford it.
Oh, definitely.
It screens people out. And if people come to it with any liabilities, like having any kind of illness, they're out of the picture, too.
Right.
Whereas a bottom-up approach is inclusive. Everybody participates, and it's participatory.
Right. And it's also a system that can evolve, because when you have transparency and public accountability, then you're able to say, to look at, and you have a system, which we don't have right now, you're able to look at it and say, what are the areas that are not working well? How can we make those areas work better? I love looking at some of the European models, because they really, no system is perfect, but they actually, what their discussion is about each year is, okay, what's not working and what can we do to fix it, as opposed to, how can we make more profit? You know, it's a really different
And there really is no way to systematically address what we have in America, because it is just a chaotic mess of tens of thousands of different systems and providers all over the place.
Right, and it changes the whole public policy, because one thing that was interesting that happened in Europe is not too long ago they passed legislation called REACH, which was designed to remove toxins from consumer products. And the reason that they did that, one of the reasons, was that they realized that they were responsible for paying for the health care of their population, and they would save a lot of money by removing toxins from these products. So suddenly, you know, health public policy is designed around creating better health. So look at what it may do to our food. I mean, right now we subsidize corn, and we have huge amounts of high fructose corn syrup in our foods, which are, you know, causing all sorts of health problems. Wouldn't our government have an incentive to remove that, you know, if they were paying for those, you know, that health care?
Oh, well, then that would not make some other very big companies, like maybe Archer Daniels Midland and Monsanto, that are involved in growing and harvesting corn, they wouldn't like it either then, would they?
Not too much, but, you know, we really do need to diversify our food sources a little bit more, so might not be such a bad thing.
Diversify our food. I think it's going in the opposite direction, all this GMO, genetically modified organism, seeds.
Exactly.
That's another problem altogether. Mm-hmm. So what's next for you?
Well, there's another roundtable discussion next week, so we're deciding, you know, what we can do to address that, and there's going to be a march and a rally in Washington, D.C. next Wednesday, so we're preparing for that. California Nurses is bringing 500 nurses to town, and I'll be speaking at the rally. Anyone who wants to come and march is invited to do that, and then the rally will be from 12 to 2 right outside of the Senate buildings. And then the nurses have planned to go and lobby, and one of their items is single-payer health care.
Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you can... I'm sorry, you can learn more about that. I think it's a healthcare-now.org website.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's been great to have you on. It's been an honor to talk to someone who has the courage to stand by her convictions and literally get arrested to speak out for other people's needs, because I'm sure you've got health insurance.
I do have health insurance. Fortunately, right now I'm healthy. But thank you so much for inviting me to be on your show, and thank you for all the attention that you're giving this issue and your work on this issue. And
we're going to keep at it.
Together, we'll get there.
And I hope that when you write, if you write, that you'll start posting what you write to opednews.com, and we'll publish it.
That's a great suggestion. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, and let and let your colleagues know about it, too. And if you're a writer out there listening, submit. We're always looking for new writing, and you don't have to be famous. You just have to be able to write intelligently and have new ideas and good ideas. So, this is Rob Cole, the Bottom Up Radio Show, WNJC 1360. I've been speaking with Dr. Mark.